Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Become a patron today at patreon.com/intotheportal. CE. In the Mongol-controlled region of what was formerly the Vladimir Oblast of the Kievan Rus, a land controlled by grand princes, long before the creation of modern Russia. Batu Khan, grandson of Genghis Khan, whose Tartar warriors had first conquered lands so cold and densely forested that no army had done so before, freezing men to death each winter beneath the falling Siberian snow. Batu Khan was in control of the Golden Horde. As the Mongols gained more territory, Grand Prince Georgi II of Vladimir commanded the construction of two cities, one large and one small, somewhere near the Volga River, in the Novgorod province, a place deep in the forest that could hide its people from the encroaching Mongol forces. The first, Malay Kitesh, the smaller of the two, was constructed. But the Khan caught wind of the stories that had been trickling through the empire, and he sent troops to destroy those who were evading him, hoarding a legendary wealth, as the rumors told. The first settlement was discovered and quickly fell, putting up little fight against the troops of the Golden Horde. But the larger Kitesh still stood, hiding deep in the forest, out of sight, invisible to the Khan's forces. They tortured those still alive from the smaller Kitesh, and eventually found the path they needed. After traveling slightly northwest, the troops finally approached the city near Lake Svetloyar, surprised to see no defenses, no archers awaiting their arrival, no battle cry. As they slowly entered the gate, the Khan's troops were stunned to see the people of Kitesh not preparing to fight, but kneeled, feverishly praying for their salvation. Given the order to attack, the Mongols charged, only to be forced back by bursting springs of water erupting from the ground beneath the city, knocking them back to the trees. They watched, stunned, as the city of Kitesh slowly disappeared beneath the waters of the lake. The last sight, the bell tower of a golden cathedral. Join us on Into the Portal for a look into a legendary place. A mythical sanctuary left to be discovered. The city of Kitesh.
Hello, and welcome back into the portal. I'm Amber Ray.
And I'm Andrew McKay. And welcome back, everybody.
Yeah, we have a whole new episode for you guys. We are heading to Russia.
Back to a relatively familiar place for us, I guess.
I guess so.
We seem to be drawn to the desert and to Siberia slash Russia myths and stuff.
Yeah, kind which could be out. Maybe classified as a different type of desert in some areas.
Like indeed, tundra, it could. Absolutely.
Thing, very dry.
Yeah.
Very barren.
It's just a fascinating place. You know, there's so much that, there's so many different oblasts. That's a word we learned that we'll get into in this episode. But yeah, it's just, it's a really cool place with tons of history.
Too.
Mysterious history. Yeah.
Because it's not obviously we're not taught Russian history in school.
Right.
So it's all new to us, which is really fun.
Absolutely. So today we are getting into something that we kind of just stumbled across, and I had definitely never heard of it before until we started to research the legendary city of Kitesh.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise known as the Invisible City.
Yeah. And we are going to pronounce it Kitesh. If anybody out there listening has a different pronunciation, if you're Russian or something, let us know. We are using that pronunciation because we heard the director Werner Herzog pronounce it that way, because he did a film about this mythical place. And we'll talk about that too.
We should have Google Translate, where they offer, you can like hear the word out loud. You can hit the
speaker.
We should do that.
Do you want to, just for fun?
I don't know.
Here, I'll get into this and you can pull it up for everybody.
Okay, let's do it.
So we're talking about this legendary city, and we'll give a little bit of the background first, but there's so much history to it that we're going to get into that as we go along, just to kind of like build the context for how this all happened. But basically, we're talking about one large city known as the Grand Kitesh or Big Kitesh, but there was also a smaller city that was built. And what we wanted to get into was like who built it and why, and the reason why it is supposedly the Invisible City. So it's kind of interesting. We started looking into Mongol history for this one, right? Because before Russia was Russia, it was the Kievan Rus. Mm-hmm. And that's something we'll talk about as we go along more and more. But it was basically just a series of princedoms and kind of like segregated states and stuff like that. There was no centralized government or anything like that. It was just a bunch of princedoms. They traded with each other.
Mm.
And it was a pretty powerful empire. I don't know if you'd call it an empire because it wasn't centralized, but it was a established region with princes that collected taxes and stuff. You know what
that kind of reminds me of is the Holy Roman Empire. Obviously Germany.
Right.
But again, made up of so many different fiefdoms, princedoms, all these different things residing close but not centralized. Yeah. So yeah, that is interesting.
So there was and obviously what comes out of that is like it was relatively peaceful, but lots of infighting, lots of stuff like that.
Lots of people trying to expand their borders at the expense of others around them.
Exactly, right? We'll get more into the Rus in a sec. But what was really cool is like we were looking into this, and of course Genghis Khan's name comes up.
Of course.
And which is just really cool.
Can't talk about the Mongols though, talking about Genghis there.
No, you can't. The Mongols are intense, man. They were an intense civilization.
But it is interesting though, because they're intense, but they're also highly civilized. And honestly, when you think of things like Mongols, you think of things like Genghis Khan and things like the Golden Horde.
Yeah.
Horde, that sounds like a bunch of orcs coming for you.
It sounds
very, not primitive, but just very like warrior culture, very harsh, very bloody, very, you know, just like gritty.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not a long lifespan on average, you might think. But you came across in the research, you were telling me earlier, that a lot of the times the wars would result in complex trade agreements and taxation and that type of thing. So it was very highly civilized.
Yeah, no, it really was. It definitely had elements of like what you just described. Like it was a brutal time to be alive, obviously. But yeah, the Mongol Empire.
Violence, disease.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But the Mongol Empire actually, you know, gave rise to modern Russia in a lot of ways. And it all started with the protectorate called the Golden Horde. And that was like confused me like crazy. Because like you just said, Golden Horde, it sounds like straight out of Lord of the Rings.
Sounds like an army.
Yeah, like you're going to have some crazy horde of soldiers come over a hill and just be like the scariest thing you've ever seen in your entire life.
Yeah.
But no, it actually, what it meant was it was just a protectorate state, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was controlled by the grandson of Genghis Khan. So Batu Khan was his name, and he was definitely feared, but he, like we just said, like, it was actually like a relatively peaceful thing. The Mongols did obviously invade, and I believe this was after the Tartar invasion. We didn't actually look into that.
Ooh.
Well, this story
is cursory glance.
This story is specific to the Mongols, and that's why we looked into them.
Exactly.
So, but basically how it went down is, we're not going into crazy detail, but they invade the Kievan Rus. They take over a bunch of the areas in the south. They take control of these princedoms and stuff, but they don't kick the princes out. And that was their claim to fame. That's how they were able to basically have such a strong empire. Mm. They said, you can stay in your spot. And this happened throughout history with other people too and yeah. stuff. But like, you know, you can stay where you are, you can keep your rule, but you're going to tax your people and you're going to give us that tax. Mm-hmm. And of course, this benefited the princes because they were skimming it off the top.
Of course.
Everybody wins, right?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, but at the same time, the regular people, like the sort of the peasant folk, they definitely saw the Mongols as like a scourge. They saw them as a, you know.
No good.
No, that they were basically showing up, ruining their way of life, and the princes were okay with it, but that just meant that they got richer and the lower class, you know, kept getting shoved to the fringes.
Well, exactly. That just breeds corruption in a certain sense, right? Because if you think about it, those princes and all those types of things, like, they wouldn't be necessarily the face of the evil. And so in a sense, they can just kind of hide behind and blame the Mongols for everything and then just sit pretty on their throne and collect whatever share they're able to collect. And it's great. They yeah. just keep going. So ruling class prevails. And it became very entrenched. Obviously, this happened up until, well, not the Mongols, but just this sort of pattern, right? This sort yeah. of type of society up until, yeah, the Russian Revolution. There's yeah. the proletariat getting crushed by the ruling class. Oh, yes. Yep. Marxists. Anyways, I don't know. that's a little tidbit.
That's a different episode. That's another history episode. Yeah, so the Mongols, like we said, they more or less were the reason for the establishment of like Moscow. Moscow was then. It was moved later. But yeah, it pushed a migration. So people were starting to move from the places they were in Kiev because the Mongols had captured Kiev. Mm-hmm. And this isn't modern Kiev that we're talking about here. This is, we'll have a map posted for people to look at because it does get kind of confusing, but you can think of this in terms of like the Black Sea mm-hmm. was the farthest western point of the Mongol Empire. And then all the way out east through Siberia, China, modern day Mongolia. Massive.
So how does this all tie into the invisible city there, Andrew?
Indeed. I'm getting to this. So, basically, how it all shook down. The Mongols were choosing these grand princes. And one of these grand princes was this guy named Prince Georgi II.
Okay.
He was in control of a province called Vladimir. Mm. And it was a smaller but very successful province. There was lots of trade. And they were doing quite well, and he was a quite well-liked guy, supposedly.
So he wasn't the bad Vlad.
He wasn't the, no. Not the impaler. No. Not that guy. So Prince Georgi II of Vladimir, he founded basically what would end up being two cities. One small, one large, like we said. It started with the small city of Malé Kitesh, which translates to small Kitesh.
Okay.
And the reason why these were built is kind of unclear. It's mainly people think it's because it was just a beautiful place to have a settlement
to be
near this lake Svetloyar, which is where this legendary city supposedly hides.
Mm-hmm. The first one wasn't by Svetloyar though. It was by a river, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
And then the story I heard was that this Prince Georgi, getting off topic. So anyways, the story I heard was that Georgi, he ended up establishing small Kitesh, and then I think it was about maybe 3 years later, he ended up going on a bit of a journey, and it was sort of like a mythical journey, sort of. He crossed these rivers that were supposedly had some sort of spiritual significance to him. And then that's when he ended up following one of these rivers or following it through the woods. And then that's where he came across.
Okay. That makes sense. Because
eventually, because there is no river actually connecting
yeah.
or outflowing or inflowing into Svetloyar Lake.
Right.
It is a completely isolated lake, entirely circular. It looks perfectly...
It's very strange looking.
It looks unnatural. It looks like it's man-made.
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does kind of look like it was dug.
Which is interesting, and we'll get into that with our theories later on in the episode, because I have a little tidbit about that, but coming at you later. So yeah, so these... this Georgi, he established these two cities, sister cities. You had Big Kitesh, Small Kitesh was the first one.
Yeah.
And then you get the arrival of these darn Mongols.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, the Mongols had been there for a bit, just not in this region.
So they're kind of in hot pursuit of them, like, so to speak. Not really. They're not, like, after them
or whatever, but basically how, they're not outright after them until they kind of catch wind of it. Because the Mongols were running their empire. It was going pretty smooth, collecting their taxes from their princedoms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of, the story goes that Batu Khan heard of this big Kitesh. Heard of this city. And he basically had to see it, wanted to conquer it. He was like, there's got to be something special about this. So he decided to invade and ransack both cities.
That's the classic case. Just like, oh, the grass is greener over there. Let's go over there. And that's like, the whole freaking country's the same, man. Come on. Like, there's lots of space for all of us.
Well, maybe. And that's actually one of the reasons why the Mongols were able to conquer such massive territories is because the majority of those territories are uninhabited.
And that's a good point. Because like in that video you're watching, there was that fun fact that you pulled out of there. That was just like, it was incredible. Like the rate of the invading Mongols.
Yeah, like the Mongols conquered technically more land in 25 years than the Romans did in 400 years. So
that's a lot. If you're thinking uninhabited spaces, vast tracts that are like
it's
this,
still really impressive though, because like, for example, the Mongols are the only peoples to ever conquer Russia in winter.
And you have to think about it too. Exactly that. And all of the struggles. Russia is literally the hardest country to invade. Yeah. Like, we've seen it over and over.
Napoleon.
Right?
Hitler struggled, right?
All these guys with modern technology at their disposal. These dudes just had swords and horses, man. Like, come on. Like, they killed it.
Yeah. So.
Which I'm just going to give a round of applause. I wonder if Mike picked up.
There you go, Batu Khan. So Batu Khan and his horde. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's a horde now.
The golden horde.
Now it actually is an army.
Yep.
So he catches wind of this. They find the first small city very easily because it is along the Volga River that you mentioned.
Oh, yes, the Volga.
And just to reiterate again, this is 13th century. Mm-hmm. Like we said that at the beginning, but 13th century. The exact dates aren't clear. So they find this first small Kitesh and people weren't giving them information on where the bigger one was because, like you said, it was kind of hidden away. Prince Georgi found it by following the Volga and then some strange pathways in the woods. And the forest nearby is so dense that it was possible to hide something relatively close by that wasn't visible.
One thing I didn't come across when I was looking into this was the actual reported size of the city. Like, I guess it's so vague, right? The account, it's more just folklore at this point. But that would be interesting. I wonder how many inhabitants would have lived
there. I
know, right?
Like, that's just it. Like, we see, like, sketches and stuff, but it's all, like,
It's paintings. And
just imaginations.
It's artist renditions.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think that the size of the lake itself, it's quite a small lake, and we'll give more details on it when we get into theories, but you'd have to think it's a relatively small city. You know, maybe
it's probably, like, more, I'm picturing it more like
1,000 people, maybe.
Really cool, like, city in the woods that's more of, like, a sanctuary and, like, just an austere place of being. Like,
right.
You know, it's very cloaked in mystery and just, like, this, I don't know, aura, right?
And that's kind of sort of what it was, right?
Like, yeah.
Because, obviously, at this point in time, the group, like, Prince Georgi and the peoples of his region in Vladimir, they were obviously very, very, very ultra-Orthodox Russian Christianity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they
that's a huge element of the story
and you know they were quite possibly the very earliest kind of offshoot of what would later become a group called the Old Believers, which were just a branch of the Russian Orthodox Church that play into this story. But it's like there's this theory that they left because they wanted peace,
and
so
they
established
kind of they were experiencing some type of
potentially religious persecution, changes in the church. That definitely is what happened to the Old Believers. And so there's this sort of idea that that's like the connection between them, right? Like they were both Russian Orthodox, religiously oppressed, about 400 years apart.
It's a parallel, for sure.
Yeah. So that's an idea. Like the city was established as a sanctuary, and that's one of the reasons why it was undefended. So, Batu Khan...
And actually, on that note, too, and how you mentioned this, the woods being so dense, perhaps that was their fortifications. And perhaps, I'm not sure if this name stuck before the legend, so to speak, or, like, the invasion, but perhaps it was called the Invisible City because it was cloaked by the woods.
Actually, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Hmm. Anyway. Well, no, and that would make sense for defense, right? Like, even that's like guerrilla warfare nowadays. You know what I mean? Like, put yourself in a position where even if you have this massive army that's attacking you, well, it's not going to matter that much because they have swords and arrows and they have to break up into individuals in the dense woods. It's almost like a 300 kind of thing, except they had the funnel into the thing, right? Where they could have a smaller group fight a larger group. But these people didn't fight. So just let me get to that. So
that's the best part.
Yeah.
The whole story.
So Batu Khan, he's not getting the information he wants. And so he takes prisoners and tortures them at the Malay Katesh, the small Katesh.
That sounds like something his grandfather would do.
Very much so. forces one to lead him at least to the entranceway of the path. So that he finds out at least where the direction is from the Volga River.
Mm-hmm.
He takes his troops. They find this path. They follow it. And they eventually come to the gates of this city, but it's totally unprotected. They can waltz right in. There's no archers, there's no guards, there's no people with weapons, there's no men standing out front ready to confront them, even verbally. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. All they see is, why don't you continue from here?
All they found were all of these citizens in fervent prayer. Just feverishly, exactly, huddled all together in unity. Basically ignoring the Mongols and not even acknowledging them and just, feverishly praying to their gods.
Yeah. And this this caught them off guard. This caught the Mongols off guard.
They were like, what? Like, that's almost like a good way to throw someone off, hey? And then, like, as they're trying to, like, you know, reevaluate, be like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah, like, what did we just walk in on here?
Right? Yeah, like, oh my goodness. Like,
we'll attack honestly, later, sorry.
Yeah, right? I would almost feel bad and be like, oh, like, you don't even have, like, a knife or anything or, like, a bow, maybe? Like, come on, let's make this a fair fight. But I don't know.
I think the feeling was obviously that they weren't paying tax, probably, right?
Like, so they were thinking, like They're just loose. Yeah. There's a burden.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you're off hiding in the woods and we control this country region and you're not paying tax. So we're going to come take your stuff or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
sounds about right.
Didn't really work out that way in the story.
So what happened? Okay. Upon the battle charge of the Mongols, they were greeted by sudden springs of water that burst from the ground, causing rivers to swallow the city until nothing but gentle waves covered its existence. Ugh, sorry, I stumbled over that. But that's really cool to think that, like, they were thrown back by the force of the water and had to retreat to the woods or risk drown.
Right.
Drowning. God, I can't talk right now. Oh, my God.
It's all good.
So they just watched as the city descended into the waters.
Just slowly submerged itself
almost into the lake. I'm picturing Titanic sinking, you know what I mean? Like, where it's just like...
Right.
And the last thing that was seen was the dome of the cathedral with its central cross on top as it slowly submerged deeper and deeper.
That's so cool.
I love it.
Yeah. Very cool. What happened right after this is kind of unclear. The story sort of stopped. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming the Mongols, like... In the legend, the Mongols must have been pretty terrified if this happened, right? I mean, you're blasted back by water that came out of nowhere. These people are praying and then they disappear. The city's gone. Probably not going to pursue them underwater and hold your breath and see what's going on.
I'm trying to picture what they would have been looking at. Like, would they have just, like... I'm picturing the citizens having, like, mermaid-like abilities all of a sudden. Like, were they just, like, Aquaman? Like, they could just, like, do that?
Well, that's a question that for the theory section, because that's a question of whether or not it's underwater or it's in another dimension or whatever.
Or if a natural disaster happened and the whole myth is just something that's sprung up as a result of, all this, like, vehement subscription to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Right.
And all this stuff. So, and the fact that the lake still exists and it is thought of as a very... A site of religious importance, to say the very least.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would actually very much like to go there.
Me too.
Not that I'm religious, but...
No, just to see. Just to feel it, you know what I mean? Like, get the aura of the place.
And yeah,
just
like if there is some sort of an energy there that can be, like, noticeable, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because there's definitely been some strange things cited, and this is in modern times, so
yeah,
it continues.
Well, they say that to this very day that those who are pious enough can hear singing from underneath the water. Mm. They can hear the bell toll from the
cathedral.
And quite often people report seeing lights under the water. Some say that the lights look as if they're candle lights for like religious ceremonies, like a procession of people with their lit candles. Sometimes it's more of like the just a bright light. What does that remind you of?
Lake Issyk-Kul / Baikal. All those USOs, unidentified submerged objects.
Because fishermen have been seeing underwater lights on Baikal and in Issyk-Kul for decades and decades.
I think the coolest part was not so much the lights, but the claims that people have seen like soldiers underneath the surface, there's been these sort of angelic beings seen in the vicinity of the lake, either around the shores or over the water itself. And we had some firsthand testimony in that documentary from Werner Herzog.
Do you want to talk about that now?
Oh, no, we can save it.
Okay.
But it was very, very interesting. Yeah, it was
very strange. So the lights, definitely reminds me of, it makes me kind of think of adding another thing to the theory section that there's potentially like USO elements to this, although the lake itself is not very deep. We'll give the stats on it in a minute, but it's not like Lake Baikal. It's not like Lake Okanagan, which we've talked about
in the Ogopogo episode.
So it's not, it couldn't keep the Empire State Building in it, basically, like some of these other large lakes and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So anyway, but where does this story actually come from? Like, we've explained it, but it's like, where do people actually first hear about it? That was one of my main questions.
Is it just oral tradition?
And that's just it. It's really strange. It's really fascinating because the residents of the region today, which is Nizhny Novgorod, that's my best attempt. They report, oral tradition basically states that the legend has been around since the earliest days of the Rus.
Nizhny Novgorod.
That's good.
Nizhny Novgorod. I've got some Ukrainian blood in me.
There you go. There you go.
And we did this borscht tonight, so.
Oh yeah, we never mentioned it. It was so serendipitous. We had Amber's mom made borscht and we were doing this episode and she had no idea.
Yeah.
It was just this very...
This is my Baba's recipe, so.
Yeah, there you go.
Good old Baba.
It's special.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these residents have basically said that it's been passed down through their families for literally centuries, that this has been a real place. And people have
centuries
been making...
Centuries and centuries.
Centuries. Like, since the 13th century, since this story, right? And even before
people
that.
People have continuously talked about this.
Yeah. But at the same time, it never actually showed up in any written document until the... Until 1688, supposedly. There's some debate about the dates. And then there's another one where it's the Kitsa Chronicle, which is basically like an old believer's text that
Kitesh Chronicle?
Sorry, Kitsa.
We've been calling it Kitsa for months.
Yeah.
And now when we watched this Werner Herzog thing, he said Kitesh. So we're like, oh.
I think Kitesh probably sounds...
We were saying it wrong the whole time. Okay.
Yeah.
But anyways, the Kitesh Chronicle.
Yeah, so this publication was actually, I think, 1780. But the actual Old Believers broke off from the church in 1688.
Okay.
So the actual text itself may have been written earlier and just surfaced later on.
Mm.
It's kind of
debatable,
up in the air.
Yeah.
But 1688 was when the Old Believers broke off from the church, and it was because of reforms. So they were basically changing, religious, some of the ceremonies, some of the practices, certain things weren't allowed. I didn't actually pull up details, and this was just in the one blog article that I looked at. It was basically just saying that, they were just making some changes, and they were so orthodox that they just outright refused these changes and broke off into their own group that still exists today, that has been traveling the world trying to find a place to be, and there's settlements of Russian Orthodox Old Believers all over in Alaska, in Canada,
That's
in northern Canada, and still in Siberia and
Russian
other places.
Orthodox. That does remind me a lot of, like, you know, the religious turmoil happening in the medieval times in Europe too, right? Like, you had the Protestant Reformation, that was like 16th century Europe, roughly, kind of ranged, but that definitely, religion played a huge part in society, hey? And like, it's so interesting in today's times when religion really doesn't play that big of a part in the political realm, so to speak. Like, obviously it does more so in different parts of the world, but not so much. We're more of a secular society now. But that is interesting to think that there would be these mandates passed down from the government. And we had, like, we had accounts where people are saying if you didn't go with it, you basically, you lost your tongue, or you lost a limb, or you lost some fingers, or you were just, you know, you were silenced. But use of violence was condoned. Absolutely. For sure. Yeah. So could you just imagine that? Like, anyways, it still happens today, though. Obviously, people are always, have always been persecuted for their beliefs and always trying to escape and find refuge. And so that's what these guys were trying to do in the 16th century.
Yeah, well, and like I said, they're kind of still trying to do it today, even though they have the freedom, but they're not as repressed, but they still struggle to operate the same way they did, you know, 500 years ago, right? 400 years ago.
Kind of reminds me of like maybe like a Russian version of like the Amish
society. It's very much like that. Yeah. Very, very similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like, you know.
I wonder what their views are on technology, right? And if they do use it or not.
No, they definitely use it, but they're not, you know, they're not busting out their new iPhone to do stuff. But I mean, they obviously would be like not, I'm sure they would use like a lighter or something, say, for example, where like maybe Amish wouldn't. I don't actually know. But you know what I mean? Like, it's not quite like that, but it's more of just trying to stay isolated so that they can retain their
almost beliefs. Like their purity.
Yeah, exactly.
And not have contamination from outside. Well, I'm going all sorts of places with this.
No, that's very much what it is, though, right? It's like
purist. Purist.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they want to keep the traditions rolling, and to do so, you have to stay away from other stuff.
That's very interesting. I would just love to be a fly on the wall. Let's go. Let's just become anthropologists and go and just study these people. We tend to do that already with the podcast. We did the People Know Fire.
I would love to
do it. Let's go to North Sentinel Island.
Oh. Yeah, bring a Nerf gun. See how long we last?
About 6 seconds till that arrow goes right into our freaking head.
I'll stick with South Sentinel. There's nobody on that island.
It's safe. It's quite lovely.
Anyway. Where was I?
We totally lost. Okay, so we're talking about the
Chronicle. The Chronicle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they came out with this written text, and they actually didn't say in this Kitesh Chronicle that it disappeared. It basically just loosely said that it went away after it was destroyed. But it was very vague. Very vague. There was no outright legend saying it was swallowed by the water. That's almost all oral tradition.
Okay.
So it's one of those things where it's tough. It's like oral traditions are so important and so fascinating, and like we've talked about so many different stories.
They enrich the culture so much. Yeah.
But obviously it's so susceptible to just like over the decades and years, it becomes something else.
Exactly. And you have to wonder, the people that are sort of continuing on with this legend, what are their motives, right? Obviously these people that were swallowed up by in the waves and into the lake, they were very holy, they're very pure, and so they were ultimately saved. So what is this kind of narrative sound like to you, right? Like, it's like, it's a very convenient way to sort of be like, oh, if you believe, if you practice, if you do this, you will be saved too, just like the people when they were in their time of need.
That's one way
in the 13th century.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
So if you think about it, it's a great moral fable, so to speak.
Yeah.
But again, not something that...
Well, the only... Yeah, I mean, totally. That totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The only other thing that's interesting, though, is that it isn't just the old believers and Orthodox, other branches of the Orthodox Church. There's pagan, still people that practice paganism that will journey to Svetlar Lake and practice stuff there. Mm. It's just because they believe that the water itself is special. The location itself is special. It's
water has such a holy function, right?
Yeah.
So purifying and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. So for the old believers, it was one thing, and for other groups, it's another. But the story of Kitesh is obviously entrenched in Orthodox Christianity.
What about the Mongol side of it? Like, do they have any record of their... You know what I mean? Like, it's just all lost to time.
Of course, yeah, pretty much.
Dang it.
Which is so sad.
We need to be friends with someone that's, like, the preeminent scholar on Mongol history.
Yeah.
If anyone listening knows that person, send them our way.
Or if you are that person,
that would be so way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you are that person. Even better. But, so basically, so there's no record of it being swallowed up underwater by Mongols. It's just kind of this loose...
Yeah.
Mythology that's been passed down.
Yeah.
And Yeah, it's all kind of up in the air as to whether or not, obviously, there was some ancient artifacts found in recent years.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
nothing really. Okay, so I think what we should do is get into some hard facts about this lake.
Okay.
Because we've already described it. It's perfectly spherical. It looks like, if you Google it, Kitesh, like, it's K-I-T-E-Z-H. So, and it's on Lake Svetloyar, so that is S-V-E-T-L-O-Y-A-R.
Yep.
Oh, I got that right.
Nice. You weren't even looking at it. I can't prove it for anybody listening, but she just wasn't looking at the computer.
I was not looking. But anyways, that's
really impressive.
I'm going to slap myself.
There you go. Like, okay. There you go.
But, yeah, so basically, okay, stats on this lake. How many meters deep is this lake, Andrew?
Wow. Yeah, that's the thing about this story. It's not that profound in terms of the size of the lake. So I think it's
the
just
length
I think
and the
it's
width.
Only 30 yeah, it's only 33.4 meters deep. Not very deep.
And it's only the max length is half a kilometer.
Yep.
Max width is I honestly thought these would be closer together. Max width is
it's more of an oval shape.
0.35 kilometers.
Yeah, it's a little bit more of an oval shape than
but
a sphere.
But it looks so...
It looks almost perfectly circular,
it does.
Though. Yeah,
yeah, from
but
the photos.
Clearly, it's obviously a little bit more of an oval shape.
But still.
Yeah, but it's that's one of the things that a lot of people will look at and be like, not buy into this in terms
no.
of, well, if you believe any of this at all or whatever, but like,
yeah.
you know, like...
If you buy into this.
Yeah, like... That it's just so shallow, it doesn't make sense. The stories on Lake Baikal with the USOs and the divers and stuff like that, like there's things going on down there. It's the deepest lake in the world. Makes sense.
Very true.
So I get that. I can kind of get that. Because on Baikal, we were only kind of loosely dabbling in the world of interdimensionality and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That comes to play way more
mm-hmm.
with this. You know,
but I honestly don't think that that's... That's not a make or break factor for me.
No, I don't think so.
Because when we get into the more theoretical elements of our conversation in the second half of this episode, it's just, the name itself, the Invisible City.
Yeah.
Is it right in front of us and we can't see it?
Very, yeah.
Anyways.
Well, that's come up before, too. Like, when we were listening to the Astonishing Legends episodes, the series on the Yeti.
Oh.
I can't remember the name of the city, but there was some city in Nepal that only those who were... Who knew the way or were of the right state of mind could actually see it. So we see that, but we come across that a lot with legendary places, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Very curious.
You know, we've got some more stuff to get into on this lake, but before we do, I think we should probably take a small break for a podcast promo, from our friends over at the Shake and Not Nerd podcast.
Oh my gosh. It was okay. This is one of the best promos I've listened to in a while.
It's pretty hilarious.
And it's a bit jarring. There might be some coarse language, so if you have sensitive ears, whatever, but it's a great show. They're great guys. They're from Australia. Love to have fun. They're a bunch of nerds.
It's hilarious.
So if you're into that kind of stuff,
it's
an awesome the world
show.
Of nerds, I'd check them out.
Absolutely.
And here it is.
Oh, hi. I didn't see you there. Well, nerds, geeks, and newcomers alike, we're the Shake and Not Nerd podcast, where each week we review movies and video games and discuss what's going on in the nerd world. With me, as always, is my co-host, Ian, the huge footlong Johnson.
Hey, babes.
The Tom.
Hello there.
And Ollie, also known as Big Red.
Hi.
And I'm your host, Doody Dutrum. And this is us.
About 5 minutes beforehand, I was talking to my friends, being like, if they make me say I love Harvey Norman, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. The second they said that, I'm like, I love Harvey Norman!
Yes! Fresh it! I'll suck it, dick, for one, it's for
honor. Pink just released a new album, which apparently is really
Thank
good.
God.
Title, Purple.
Pink, right.
No. Two in the.
Where can people find us, guys?
Why are you looking at me this time?
Well, I do believe you can find us on any relevant social media outlets.
Or the podcast app of choice.
Mm.
Oh, there are a lot of good ones. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Shaken Not Nerd.
And we're back. So make sure to head on over to podfixnetwork.com and you can find Shaken Not Nerd, and we are on there as well.
Yeah, Podfix fans.
A bunch of other amazing shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we left off talking about the lake. Right? I think.
Let's hope. That's what this episode's on.
Yeah. Just freaking team me up for failure, I feel like. Just... So, I mean, did you have anything specific that you wanted to mention? Because there's a few other points here for sure.
Definitely, yeah. This lake is just so interesting to me because of what's been found there, because of what hasn't been found there, as far as, like, there being remnants of this mythical city with a big-ass cathedral or anything, you
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, it has been remnants found of past civilizations that have formed there.
Yeah.
And it's even debated whether... We didn't even get into the formation of the lake itself.
Do you
want to
talk about that right now? Maybe we should.
Yeah, because it is a bit murky. There's various ideas. One is the idea that it was perhaps a glaciated valley and maybe a depression caused by a glacial melt. Maybe.
The other is that this one's a little more interesting, that it is a crater left from an ancient meteorite strike.
Yeah.
And it basically left that hole. The only thing that about that that's sort of maybe doesn't match up is that this lake is so clear and so clean and so warm that it is unlike any other...
Warm, eh?
Yeah, apparently. It is unlike any other body of water beyond the Volga River in that forest.
Well, that actually does make sense to me, because if a meteor striked at that particular location, maybe it actually opened up a natural spring or some sort of source.
That's what I was going to say, because obviously there's water coming from somewhere to keep this thing full.
Well, a huge collision like that could potentially...
I wonder.
You know,
like groundwater from the Volga River or something like that. Because that's one of the interesting things about it, why people think it's so mythical and special, is because this water is so pure and so sweet, but it's like nobody knows exactly where it's coming from. They've gone down and they've trolled the lake, looking for the remnants of ancient civilization and looking for, you know, other just things of interest. And it's still just unclear. It's unclear how it was created, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, you think they would be able to determine something. But again, this is Russia we're talking about. I don't know. They've got a lot of lakes over there, man.
Yeah, maybe they haven't gone to that one yet in terms of, like, official. They've labeled it as a protected natural monument.
Yeah. You know what's funny, though? When you do look, if you happen to Google search this lake at all, and you come up with the photos, and it kind of just looks like a glamorized pond.
it does.
It's very... It definitely looks man-made.
Yeah.
And it just looks like a very... It just reminds me of something you'd find in a bird sanctuary, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it's kind of, it's out of place, but like not, because it's so beautiful and it looks, you know, it's very unique. And so what's been found there is even more unique. So some people tie this to Kitesh. Some people say the dates aren't exactly, they don't necessarily match up to the 13th century, but researchers have found one of the first expeditions was in 2011. They found shards of pottery that dated to the correct time period. They found iron knives, pieces of a harness, you know, just like other random stuff. They also found something that you mentioned. Actually, no, did you mention this? Or maybe it was just when we were chatting before. They found log cabins.
Oh, the log cabins, yeah.
Which is like kind of crazy.
That's weird, man. Like, how old are these log cabins?
Yeah, so those were about a half meter to a meter below the surface of the lake.
Okay.
I couldn't find any direct information on the dates, like if it was carbon dated or like if it was from the 13th century. It was just very unclear. The researchers seem to be suggesting that it was a little bit more recent, probably more like 17th century, something like that.
Okay.
So not several not the hundred right years later, you know, but it's still kind of, I don't know, like it's still kind of evidence to me in the sense that obviously there were people that wanted to be at this location. Maybe the reason they were there after the 13th century was because of the legend, because of the story, because they knew that this was a holy place.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe people are just naturally attracted to it.
Right.
You know, like,
because people do say that they'll go there and it'll cure ailments, right? Like, people will say, like, I have cancer and I swam in the lake and it cured me.
Wow.
Or I, you know, or the opposite.
Oh, that was my favorite anecdote about
this. Yeah, why don't you tell that?
Well, you were the one that told me.
The opposite of that would be the people that still live in the area and that make these pilgrimages to the lake and, you know, wet their face and all this kind of stuff. They'll say that those who disrespect the lake and those who disrespect the area around it will meet the consequences, basically.
Like, he'll be cursed or something.
Yeah, like, huh? Essentially. So, the story, there's been many stories, and the one that this Russian woman was talking about in the Bells from the Deep movie, Werner Herzog, basically said that this guy chopped a tree down right by the shore.
That's a no-no.
He almost instantaneously stopped breathing, and they got him back to his house nearby, and he convulsed and died.
Wow.
For inexplicably.
Jeez.
And supposedly that's happened to many people. I don't know if it's just for chopping down trees, but I don't know. Can you go fishing on this lake? Maybe you wouldn't want to. I don't know.
That's a good question, right? Actually,
yeah. I honestly think you probably can't because it's like a protected reserve or whatever.
Not, yeah. But let's get into that then, that Werner Herzog thing. That was so funny because that was kind of the kickoff for me for research on this episode. And when we sat down to watch it, I felt like I was so severely dislocated from any other film experience I've ever had in my life.
That's a Werner Herzog film.
Yeah, right there. It was very, very fascinating, to say the least. And this woman in particular, she was kind of the main focus. It was her, and then there was a couple other figures that we saw quite regularly. Mm-hmm. I don't even think they had names, though. They
Good question. Could've. Well, it's called Bells from the Deep.
Yes, Bells from the
Deep. The first half of the movie is all kind of like about religion and like the Orthodox Church. And then at about 34 minutes in to the rest of the film is all about Kitesh. And yeah, it was, like you said, it was all kind of followed this one lady.
Yeah, she was adorable. I loved her, but she was just the typical, just crusty, hardened Russian lady.
Like outback lady, she like had living a story in the woods.
About how she was living with a pig, and this must have been in her youth, because I don't know how she would have done it at her current state, because she was quite elderly. But mind you, she was making pilgrimages to the lake at this time, too, and crawling around on all fours on the icy surface. So anyways, I think she's quite capable.
Yeah.
But she was saying the one anecdote about how the pig just went crazy one day. It went crazy.
The pig went totally berserk.
Totally berserk. And chased her. What did it do? It, like, knocked over her dog or some other animal was in the vicinity, and it basically just, like, bowled her over. She managed to get up and ran to the house. And then she slammed the door and fell on the ground. And the pig, it was hammering at the door, wanting to get in. And then she says how she shooed it into its pen. How do you shoo a rabid pig into its pen?
I don't know.
She shooed it in, and then what did she do?
Well, that was her story, because the pig, like, bit her on the leg, and then she went to the lake.
Right. That was the whole... I was like, why the hell is she telling that story?
Yeah, like, the pig, like, bit her or something, and because it, like, went nuts, and and then she went and healed her leg in the lake, I think it was, or something like that. But it was totally bizarre, because the rest, like, after that, he interviews some people, well, sort of. I mean, I don't know if you'd call it that, but it's kind of this loose, strange filming style.
Oh, so weird.
But it basically, I mean, it is, it's like a docudrama. It's a documentary, but it's dramatized, obviously.
Yeah.
They show people who are still to this day do this, like you mentioned, on the ice. It's in the winter. They're crawling out on the ice and looking through, like, wiping away with their hand through the snow.
Yeah.
And they're on their stomachs.
Cracking ice. Right? Because it's such a warm lake. Yeah, you can hear it cracking.
Exactly. So they know you can't walk because you'll fall right through. So they spread out their weight, and they're sort of worming their way along, like these elderly Orthodox Russian people.
They're using their elbows and and they're just looking straight and, like, putting into
their... Yeah, like, so, like, for listeners, I'm trying to make this visual.
Yeah.
Like, putting their hands to the sides of their head, like, looking through binoculars. And trying to see through the ice.
Yeah.
And basically they claim that they can sometimes see, you know, their people. Like, see the...
They see...
Inhabitants of Kitesh.
Yeah.
Beneath
angelic
the water.
Angelic beings, lights, the chorus of hymns. There was one instance, the same lady was telling us that she was basically on this type of trip. Or I don't even know what you call it.
Well, it's a
activity.
Pilgrim. Yeah.
It's an activity. And
it's an interesting activity.
A very interesting
hobby. What do you do on the weekends?
What do you do in your free time? Oh, you know, I'm just going to trek it up to Lake Svetloyar and I just kind of crawl around on my legs and my...
You guys got to go check it out. It's on YouTube. It's
so
funny. We'll
add
it to our
channel.
It's
not funny, but it's just, it's pure fascination for me. Yeah. So I'm just like, whoa, like this is just extreme. And so she had this one account where she was on the ice crawling for hours and hours and hours. And she was getting to a point where she was almost delirious or something. She was kind of just whatever. And not to discredit her at all for saying that, because in a sense, maybe she was getting closer to what spiritual place she was trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And then she happened to look up, she said, and she saw a group of angelic beings, and she went to them. She went after them,
right.
Like walked towards them.
Yeah.
And they were in deep prayer. And what they would do is they were in this group, and they kind of were like moving, and then they would stop along the way. There's just through the woods now, so she wasn't on the lake anymore.
Right.
And she would every time they would stop to pray, she would stop too and pray. And then they would move along, and she would continue praying until she was done. And then she would move to the next spot where they were and pray with them too. So it was a very highly religious experience that she had.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if she came to any sort of, I don't even know, like not a nirvana, but like some sort of...
Like a religious epiphany of some kind or whatever.
Yeah, some sort of thing going on there. I don't know. But it was very...
That's a strange
experience. It was a very significant experience for her, to say the least. And she definitely believes in the spiritual aspects. And... Yeah, for me, it bleeds into the paranormal because you get a lot of accounts where even with things like sleep paralysis or like, what's it called? Like the shadow people.
Yeah.
Some people describe those not as ghosts. Well, some people describe them as ghosts. Some people describe them as angels. You get this whole kaleidoscope of different interpretations. So my question is this a religious interpretation of paranormal phenomena?
That's a really good question.
Mm-hmm.
Are we getting into our theories and discussion here then? We can kind of jump back to some other stuff.
Kind of trickle into it.
I think we should.
But
I think
there was, there's so much going on with this episode too. It's almost hard to structure it properly. And did you have anything else you want to cover before we dive into theories? Or?
Well, I think I have a few points I'll come back to when we're talking about some theories. So we can just get into it. And we can start with that, with the idea that, is this a religious interpretation of, paranormal, something paranormal. But at the same time, it's like the story goes is sort of like they manifested it.
Yeah.
So like something I would want to know, which we'll never be able to find out, is if the lake or if the region had any other kind of like significance or energy or paranormal before Kitesh, which of course we'll never know. Whereas like with Baikal, we kind of know because the indigenous peoples that live there, they have oral traditions and stories that date back even further.
Where are these people here? There's no Evenki, is there? Like there's no,
the Evenki are way further east.
Just for quick reference, Evenki is just an indigenous group.
Yeah. So the Evenki are like reindeer herders. They're further east in Siberia. Southeastern Siberia, as far as I know.
They're always cited when we're talking about things like the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Yeah.
They're in that.
Evenki and like the Mansi.
Oh, the Mansi too.
I believe is another one. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different indigenous peoples around in this area of Svetloyar too, but I couldn't find anything.
It's probably
significant.
All in Crazy Russian dialects.
Probably.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Again, if anyone out there's
If anyone
Russian,
speaks Russian, yeah, or if you speak Russian or if you have any information on any of this or other stuff too, because we love Russian stories. So like, we'll definitely want to do more. So,
and when we were studying this, I actually got slightly confused for a nanosecond because I thought this was the same city that we discussed really briefly in the Lake Baikal episode. And what number was that? I don't even know.
Oh man, that was like 4 or 5 episodes ago now, maybe more. I can't remember.
It was quite a while ago, but we were discussing this one story that was discussing this king or prince. I don't know if he's a king or a prince, but he was a ruler and he had his own little kingdom on the shores of Lake Issyk-Kul. And the story goes that this king had, unfortunately, a little bit of an issue. He had asinine ears, like literally like donkey ears. And so every time he got his hair cut, he would murder his barber in order to keep his secret because he was so ashamed of it. And one day he decided, I'm not going to kill this barber. I'm going to let him go and hope he keeps his word. And the barber did, except he whispered the secret into a well. And the well sprung up with this flow of water. It was like a spring. And it actually swallowed up the entire city. And now it's rumored that this city is at the bottom of Lake Issyk-Kul.
Wow.
Or near the bottom along one of the shores. And that, again, Lake Issyk-Kul is just a treasure trove of all sorts of stories like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Literally, yeah. There's millions of dollars of gold supposedly buried there from a train wreck during the Russian Revolution. So that's just
was
one
that
side
Baikal or that's Baikal?
No, that's Issyk-Kul.
Okay, crazy. Because there's gold in Baikal too.
Oh
yeah.
Oh, maybe I have that confused. No, I'm pretty sure the train story, right? The big train story, and then there was was the Reds, and they were...
That's Baikal.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. No, but there is gold stories in Issyk-Kul, too. There's definitely sunken treasures in that lake, 100%.
There's all sorts of weird stuff
and
going on
that was
there.
Where the skeletons were from that Baikal episode, right? And yeah. From the Georgian boys, right? That
Holy
went diving
moly.
Down.
Okay, Unknown Siberia, Secrets of the Depth. Sorry, I'm just looking at her blog right now just for quick reference, but that was episode 9.
Wow.
And we're on episode...
16?
We're on episode 16?
I think.
17,
Holy
18.
Moly, time flies.
I think it's 18.
No. Is it?
Yeah, because...
No, that makes sense.
And now we're just going on a random topic. Yeah. No, this is the behind the scenes of Into the Portal
there you
right
go.
Now.
Yeah, oh. There you go.
Extra footage, guys.
Okay, well, let's move through these discussion things here then. So,
yeah.
What's your... Okay, are we kind of moved on from the first one? I mean, what's your...
Well, the idea that... What, like, the thing that I threw out there with...
Yeah, just like with... I mean, I guess...
The idea that it's a religious interpretation of paranormal phenomena, because we, yeah. Like we discussed, you get the USOs.
Yeah.
Like, unidentified submergibles that are these lights supposedly yeah. emanating from the depths.
Right.
We get things like angelic beings that could be interpreted in different ways. Some people even... You know, it's weird. Like, back in the day... I'm talking biblical here. Like, because, like, I've often thought about this myself, where the accounts describing angels in biblical times and things like that, those could be seen as entities from another dimension. Those
right.
could be seen as alien.
Yeah.
Like, it's just your lens of interpretation, right? And so when some people have, like, even... glowing orbs have been interpreted as angelic beings.
Yeah.
And sometimes in some accounts, they actually communicate with the individuals either telepathically or whatever. And there is, it's just really interesting. I feel like a lot of our interpretations in modern day of these types of phenomena come from our secular background, and that we don't necessarily see something that's floating and slightly humanoid or whatever and
yeah,
think
there's
that's
one,
an angel.
There's one lens.
Yeah.
Right?
We think
there's
that's,
one lens
that's
back
an
then.
Alien. That's the Flatwoods Monster. That's
right.
the, you know, like, whatever. Like,
yeah.
you know? So it all comes down to the context
yeah.
and what you believe.
Right.
And that's kind of gets into another sort of idea you had that was like, does belief manifest reality?
Yeah. I mean, I've brought this up. Not necessarily on the show that much, but yeah, in conversations with you before, and I genuinely believe that it can.
Mm.
Just on a, I don't think this is proof, but like if you think about even ourselves and like the power of the mind, like what we can convince ourselves
mm-hmm.
of,
yeah.
and how that will physically affect us.
It
those are
affects our reality.
Yeah,
and our perception
it,
of
exactly.
It.
You know, those are. That's all biological, and that's something that can be kind of, you know, narrowed down to on paper, like, this is why this happens, but it's still really fascinating to me. I genuinely believe that it can. Like, if these people, even if their belief in Orthodox Christianity is false or whatever, right? They're misinterpreting or they're misappropriating whatever, it's the energy of it. If they're all there and they're praying and they're kneeled down and they believe enough... It's not necessarily if what they're believing in is real. It's just that they're all focused on
totally.
It.
Totally.
Right?
And you even get into the type of thing with, I've been reading into, like telekinesis, ability to move objects with your mind. And there was this one account from a Fate article that was discussing this one dude. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he held conferences for this like every year. And this was back in, like, the 90s. He said he had a breakthrough with this group that was able... None of them had ever done it before. And they were basically kind of... they had an object placed in a hermetically sealed case. And I think the goal was just to shift it. Just to move it
okay.
slightly. And I can't remember what the percentage was, but an astonishing majority of people were actually able to do this. And it was like, it was just bizarre.
Crazy.
And he was just ecstatic about it. He was like, this proves the power of the mind. And so if you think about it, yeah, the mind manifests your reality and it defines our limits of perception. So biology, belief, like
yeah.
all, they work together.
Yeah.
And
there's obviously elements to it that we just don't know.
Totally.
And so
the powers of religion. And even there was that quote from Father Nikolai, and he is part of the old believers. And this is a quote from him. He says, "If we stop believing and stop going to church and observing the Orthodox way of life, we would cease to exist."
That's interesting.
That is very interesting.
Like, and he, yeah. So just to reiterate, so like the Father Nikolai, so this is from the group of the Old Believer Orthodox sect that's in Alaska right now, currently.
Oh.
So this is a modern quote. This is like from the 2000s.
I didn't realize. I thought he was in Russia.
No. Yeah, this is one of the ones. No, because they felt. Yeah, so there are still Old Believers there, but like many have felt persecuted. There's Old Believers in South America. They're all over. They've made pilgrimages around the world trying to find their place to settle down. And I suppose Alaska makes the most sense. It's sort of the most similar geographic.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know.
Like climate and all that.
Climate and everything.
Yeah, it's very, lots of space up there in Alaska.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go but see, that's... what's her face, the Alaskan governor.
Oh, yeah, great. Does he literally believe that, though? Like, is that a literal interpretation? I kind of think so. It sort of reads that way.
I feel like it does, too.
You know?
It's not like he's saying our purpose to exist would cease to be. He's saying we would cease to exist.
Yeah.
That's very powerful language.
Yeah, because it's not just him. It's the entire group.
It's the practice. It's the methodology. It's the everyday. And you hear that in all sorts of, like, you know, like people join a cult. And that defines their life. And if they aren't in that, they're basically just like a shell of a person.
Yeah.
And that goes without saying for a lot of stuff. Like even if we were to up and stop the podcast today, I would probably cease to exist in a lot of ways, right?
That's an interesting, You would, I guess. That makes sense.
Yeah, a big part of me would disappear.
And that's true. Very true.
Epiphanies.
Epiphanies here. So the question is, though, is like, how does this translate into like something metaphysical that's also like tangible? You know what I mean? Because obviously the Mongols, as the legend goes, saw this city disappear. Mm-hmm. So if they could manifest a reality through energy, through their praying, either A, that means they're right. And Russian Orthodox Christianity is what everybody should be doing. or, like we said early on, it's just, they crossed over. They were in the right place at the right time and emitted enough of the right energy in the right place to
save themselves.
Yeah, transport themselves.
But this is where we kind of get to that whole interdimensionality aspect, because when I hear the invisible city, I almost feel as though it points to something that is really existing right in front of me and I can't see it.
Right.
And it's because I am not a true believer. And if I was to go to this Lake Svetlolayar, I wouldn't see it. And when you look at the photos, again, just going back to the perfectly circular nature, not perfectly circular,
very, very circular
nature, and how it almost appears to be like a man-made pond. Yeah. In my mind, I was almost thinking like, ooh, what if this is really just like a massive moat that sort of like, it's just like, it's like a spherical sort of like force field around that the city just like is encompassed within it. And you can't see it until you've sort of achieved that sort of, I want to call it chi or something. You know what I mean? You've got to that point.
Right.
Where you are enlightened enough to be that exception and to actually enter the fold of this place.
Interesting.
Ooh, I love it. I love it so much.
You know, I think that's cool too, the idea of like an ancient moat, because it's not clear how the lake was made.
Well, that's, there you go. Maybe it actually was a fortress.
Well, like we talked about in the Baikal episode, there's been skeletons discovered, Denisovan skeletons discovered in Russian caves that were found with artifacts that weren't of the same era, that weren't placed there because it was sealed off and hadn't been discovered. So it kind of loosely proved that more ancient peoples were more capable of higher technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, I think it was the Scythians?
Yeah.
That was like 8,000 BC or something, and they were migrating north. Could there have been some sort of an empire not empire, but could there have been some sort of
a civilization.
Civilization and establishment there
mm-hmm.
well before the Kievan Rus, which would have started in like 882 mm-hmm. AD, was like one of the first princes of the Kievan Rus, Prince Oleg, in mm-hmm. In the same region, in Novgorod.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 882 AD. What about 8000 BC, right? That's a lot of time.
It is a ton of time. And I actually really like that idea. It's almost like the 13th century could have been a recycling of a previously used sacred site.
Spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, and because there is no, when you get into the origin story of this, right, you get the Prince Georgi going and finding this sort of very pristine, very holy spot,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. And you don't hear anything about him actually constructing the city at all. Obviously that did happen, but you don't hear about him constructing a lake. The lake was already there.
Yeah.
It was already there. It was already. So in that sense, yeah, I don't know. It's all up for debate, people.
No, it totally
We want to know what you think is the most interesting or perhaps the most accurate.
Yeah.
Because it could go either way. I love this story. It's just, for me, it's half fairy tale and half history.
Yeah. Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the reason why it's been dubbed the Russian Atlantis.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a really good way to put it.
It's the, people have found ruins that could be linked to supposedly, I'm air quoting, Atlantis.
Yeah.
Nothing's definitive. There were, actually, we kind of didn't finish giving the details on some of the findings, so there wasn't that much more. But basically, yeah, they found the log cabins and also outlines of buildings further down. But the problem was that it was so much smaller than what a city could have been considered. Okay. It was just like a smaller settlement.
Like, yeah.
And I think we mentioned it earlier, but like the area is supposedly really susceptible to landslides.
Oh, right.
And that's one of the main theories as to what may have happened if there was indeed a Kitesh city there, that it could have been crushed by a landslide, and as simple as that. But if that's the case, though, if that's the case, there's going to be way more artifacts.
I'm not buying this landslide thing.
No, I'm not buying it either.
I'm looking at these photos. This is a freaking really flat area of land, people. There's not a single hill in sight. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
Well, that doesn't make any sense, then.
Look at it. Look at it. Because they can see.
Well, it might be from over. There might be.
Really, though?
Well, I don't know.
It seems really... Ooh, look at that. You can see the depth there. That's cool. I'm going to bookmark that one.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Google.
Honestly, that doesn't seem very likely for a few different reasons. Obviously, we've only seen Google pictures and stuff. It's tough to tell unless you're there.
I feel like it's a stretch, but you know what? I'm just going to say it's possible.
Sure.
Who knows?
Well, that's just like
people are suggesting it. If researchers have been there and been like, this is from a landslide.
Well, and it's just but at the same time, though, that's the classic non-paranormal, like, maybe potentially reaching, right? Like,
that's
like
the owl
theory.
I
was just gonna say, that's like the Jonah Claw. Oh yeah, it was an owl 9 feet up on a branch. It's like, well, is that more likely than the paranormal side? Like, not to me.
No.
Like, in certain circumstances, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm buying that, though. Obviously, when you're looking at land from an aerial perspective, though, it does look a lot flatter than when you're actually there.
Yeah.
So, I'll just give those guys the benefit of the doubt, I guess.
Right.
Even though from my angle, it's not looking very hilly.
Yeah.
But
The other thing that this made me think of, too, like when we were getting into researching for the theories and stuff, in the Baikal episode, I can't remember the name of it. I should have pulled it up. We referenced one of the Russian folklore creatures, and it was basically like the Russian mermaid.
Oh shoot, I can't remember that either.
And I thought I put it in here, stupid. But we go back and listen to the Baikal. What was the title of that one anyway? Siberia.
It was called The Secrets of the Depths.
Secrets of the Depths. Yeah. They there's basically a Russian mermaid in Russian folklore that is kind of benevolent and sort of reminds me of like people seeing these things beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if potentially that has something to do with it too. Like if, you know, you're praying because you're Russian Orthodox, but maybe something else answered your call.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like maybe it's not just because of energy and manifesting your safety because you transfer to another dimension or whatever, but there's reports of creatures being seen, and that ties into the Baikal 9-foot humanoid swimmers too.
Interesting. Right?
Whether or not they're literally down there in a house at the bottom, or if they're also interdimensional. And if that's the case, And water is clearly has something to do with it, right? It's always in water out in Russia here.
Yeah.
Then
oh, water. So
perhaps
scary.
These people's prayers were answered by something other than their savior that they thought.
Ooh,
and
that's
that there
spooky.
Might be more to this to some of the folklore
what
stories.
If they were damned to the depths. Sorry. That was harsh.
Yeah. Just we think they're saved and they're still praying down there, but no. But no.
No, they're singing, they're trying, they're chiming the bells, trying to get people to notice them and come save them.
Oh, man. That's depressing.
Oh, no, it's not. No,
that would that's, be a terrible, that's like purgatory.
Yeah. I prefer to think of it as just like an underwater sanctuary.
Yeah. So, yeah. What else do you have, what else do you have to say on this?
Well, I think we've covered the main sort of gambit with the whole idea that, yeah, we've got this, like, really significant religious aspect that these people basically define themselves by.
Yeah.
And then you get what we kind of come at all this weird stuff with, which is the paranormal angle. So that's kind of our lens of interpretation, but not the only one, obviously. It's just an intersection between religion and interdimensional beliefs, I believe.
Yeah, I think so too.
Beliefs, I believe. I know. I'm a very agnostic person myself, but...
Yeah.
This is just such a fun story for me. I love it. I know there's going to be more, and I feel like I didn't exhaust by any means the research for this, and if anyone else has anything that they want to put their 2 cents in worth, like, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What about you? What is your conclusions on this?
Yeah.
Because you did the main leg as far as the research goes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of, it's different than the Baikal episode where we had more evidence, quote unquote, to draw on for being like, there's Russian naval reports and right. There's different things. This is all oral tradition. But the part to me that stands out the most is the fact that the oral tradition extends so much further back than the initial old believers documentation of this and that Kitesh was a mythical that it was a real place and that it was a sacred place, but nobody wrote it down.
That's why? Typical though. That's, I mean, so typical,
I guess.
Like, if you don't have
I guess people couldn't read.
Well, that's just it. Like, yeah, if you don't have a predominantly illiterate society, we see that obviously in our own country, right, with the indigenous groups, they did not have anything but an oral tradition,
right?
And
right,
then we
right.
came, we were like, we gotta civilize you and you know, get them into these residential schools and get them reading and writing all this stuff, and look where it's got them. Not very, like, obviously there are people doing a lot better than some, but overwhelmingly
but the tradition, the oral traditions were lost a lot of the time.
Exactly. And it's so unfortunate. Yeah. I was so happy when we talked to Corley over at the West Bank First Nations when we did our Okopogo episode, just to see that it's coming back. And she told us, she's like, you know, people are relearning their indigenous heritage, their indigenous language, and maybe we might see even more of that. I don't know how stunted it was in Russia, though, because I don't think they had anything quite as severe as what we had in Canada with the settler population sort of clashing with the indigenous population. It was kind of a little more entrenched over there already.
Mm-hmm.
You get massive influxes of pioneers and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's all very fascinating. I want to just go there and get some more first-hand accounts and do some...
Wouldn't that be sweet to go and have a translator and do some interviews or something like that?
Oh, it reminds me of when I was reading... the book, not McCloskey's book. It was the other account from the Baikal incident. It's right on the shelf there behind you, Andrew. Not The Mountain of the Dead by McCloskey, but Dead Mountain by, what's his name there? Thank you, Donnie Eicher.
Ah.
It just reminded me of his, because he was just an American that sort of stumbled across the story. Just like we stumbled across this story, and he went there, I think it was either 2 times or 3 times, I can't remember, but it was just fascinating for him, right, because it was just so foreign, and he had to rely on interpreters, he had to rely on people from the Dialog Foundation, and he was lucky enough to actually get that information and have their help, but yeah, it would be really fun if we could do something very similar and even write our own little book, perhaps.
That would be so cool. Because there isn't really much out there on this story, and it's really one of the cooler ones that we've come across. You know, if I had to have like one more thing to say, I guess it would be that I find it, if we were to try to kind of work any of this into quote unquote evidence, it would be that there are obviously establishments that were found under the water, pottery that dated back to the 13th century. The establishments themselves didn't match up with the dimensions of a city, but the oral traditions do. They talk about it.
And you have to wonder, too, if this area is prone to landslides, what's covered up?
If it is prone to landslides, totally. I honestly think that theories can't be true. Can't be. Like, I'm looking at the pictures, it's just like, it's a tree-lined lake. If this place is prone to landslides, there's going to be a section where there's no trees. These trees are hundreds of years old.
There's going to be scarp sort of, what's it called? You're looking at me like, what is she talking about? It's basically when you have, it's a technical term for when you have a very steep cliff,
yeah.
And then you at the bottom you get these piles of debris, essentially, and rocks and whatever. And it's like it's escarpment kind of a thing. Oh, I totally butchered that.
That's
I wish we had Dana around.
Yeah, needing our geologist.
She's an actual geologist.
That's right.
Yeah, but you would think there would be evidence of that. Like, I took one geography course in university, and I feel like I can kind of. It doesn't look like a landslide.
No, it doesn't. And then obviously there's just the fact that, I mean, people can believe what they believe, and it's obviously, a lot of it's probably just that, it's just their beliefs. But people, you know, year over year, report seeing the lights, report hearing the bells, report hearing singing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like some of that's got to be, somebody's hearing something.
Unless it's just the conditions, because it is very harsh, and like these people, they subject themselves to, I don't know if they subject themselves to deprivation as like in food, or like, you know, if they're fasting while they're doing this, if they're indulging, not in say like psychedelics or anything, but if they are sort of depriving themselves
drinking
and sort
maybe
of,
or something,
well,
or
not even drinking, but if they're in such a severe religious fervorous state,
oh, for
that
sure.
they're, you know, like, they, yeah. like they could possibly conjure up things from their mind. And that's exactly where we get into the whole, like, yeah, like mind over matter, or like, does the mind create the reality?
But it's just a question of whether or not those things can be real. It's like with Buddhism, where when we were watching some of like Crash Course videos, like looking at Mongols and stuff, and there was the one on China and ancient China and ancient whatever Buddhism and how it made its way over to China and stuff. And it's just like the idea that like the Buddha, the original Buddha, starved himself sitting under a tree for however long, and then has this epiphany, and it's all just from not being in the same state of mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That was so telling, that one sentence where he basically just said, life is suffering. Life is defined by suffering. Suffering comes about as a result of desire. If you have no desire, you have no suffering.
Right.
And these are the ways, he had like a eightfold sort of methodology on how to lessen your desire / eliminate it.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted that myself. Maybe we should become Buddhist.
I know, right? But it's almost like that, but that, the reason I brought that up too is like, because it made me think of Kitesh, because it's a city built under, you know, Orthodox Russian Christianity, but it was undefended. It was there was no negativity. There was no anything, right? It was just pure. It wasn't worried about anything else. It was avoiding temptation of the rest of, you know, princes taking taxes and, you know, doing their thing over there. It was separate and peaceful, very much like, kind of like the Buddhist mentality almost. I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Very.
So, yeah.
That basically wraps it up.
Yeah. Is Kitesh a real place? Was it a real city? Was it swallowed by the water? Could it have just been an older settlement that got ransacked by Mongols and just turned into a legend? Could it have been a landslide?
Who knows?
I personally think that the people of Kitesh are still there, and that the people are hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe in interdimensionality. I always have.
Another interesting thing, too, is the fact that there have been no skeletal remains found.
Indeed.
I just had that light bulb go off my head.
Right.
But, you know, obviously,
that's either evidence or not.
Yeah.
You could argue either way.
Yeah.
But it's,
The plot
very cool.
thickens.
Yeah.
So let us know what you thought about this episode. We'd really love to hear from you. We are really, really, really hoping that our regular listeners will perhaps submit their own iTunes review. We would really love to hear from you.
Yeah, that would be great.
It's kind of slowed down lately, but it helps the show so much.
Yeah.
And we realized too, like, we've had people that we know that have submitted reviews and they don't show up on iTunes.
Yeah, they don't always show up sometimes. It's silly, but
it's really dumb and I hate it, but we encourage you to do it anyway. And just throw out a 5-star if you have a
por favor. Yeah, we really, really appreciate it. It helps out the show. Yeah, so, so much.
Muchas gracias.
And even if, like, you don't use iTunes or whatever, Facebook, you can leave a review for us on there. It all helps. And just tell a friend about the show. You know, if you like the show and you think somebody else might like it, please tell them, because we're really trying to grow. And we just want to bring as much weird stuff to the world as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a sec, please leave us a review. We really appreciate it, guys. You're the best fans ever. It's awesome. We love doing the show.
Yeah, we really do.
And what else? I mean, you can find us on,
You know, our regular socials. We are, go on our website, intotheportal.com.
Yeah, a new blog is up there not for this episode, but for
just for Amelia Earhart, last week episode. Yeah, go check that out. And then, of course, we'll have all the resources updated for Monday morning.
Yes, indeed.
And as well,
Come chat with us on Facebook
exactly.
and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, we have a Facebook group going. It's growing steadily, which we're really happy about. We've got a few more active members there, which is, it just makes my day every time I see that stuff.
Mr. Castaneda. Thank you, sir.
Woo! Yeah, you're the best, man. Yeah. I love you. But otherwise, we also have a really active Twitter account. It's Into the Portal
Into
the Portal 1. Yeah. And then I'm on there too as Amber Ray 1992.
Yeah. So come chat with us. Let us know any thoughts, anything. Yeah. You have any paranormal thoughts or episode ideas
Instagram,
or whatever.
We're always on there too, posting stuff.
Absolutely.
Like, Into the Portal.
What is it? Into the Portal podcast.
Into the Portal podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, thanks again so much for listening to this episode. And until next week.
Yeah. Until next week.
From the Podfix Network. You can check out more shows like it at podfixnetwork.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.